Greetings and welcome back. We're ready for another session, and this time we're going to continue our discussion of the nature of self-evident beliefs. Last time we went over the three characteristics of a self-evident belief that we can know just by reflecting on our own self-evident beliefs. We can notice that we form beliefs without inferring them from anything else. I gave you several examples. The perceptual belief of looking out the window and seeing that it's raining. I don't draw the conclusion that it's raining from other things that I believe. I'm forced to believe that it's raining because I see it right in front of my face. So it's the experience that's not derived from any other. It's experienced as prima facie true. That means right on the face of it, all I look at it and it looks right. And its experience is irresistibly true. I don't reflect on, oh, there seems to be moisture in the air. Oh, it seems to be splashing on the windowsill. Maybe it's raining. No. You look out and you see it's raining and it forces on you, it creates in you the belief that it's raining. Now, those are the descriptive characteristics. Those are the ones we can know by reflecting on our own experiences and seeing that they conform to this. In addition, however, there have been three very famous restrictions placed on it by the theories of some influential thinkers. First of which was Aristotle. And the second of which was Descartes. They lived a very long period of time apart. Aristotle died around 300, 330 BC. And Descartes died in 1650 AD. So they are almost 2,000 years apart. And yet they contribute to the same tradition. It has to be experienced, Aristotle says. If it's genuinely self-evident, it will be experienced as self-evident by all the experts in the field in which it arises. That's in the case of sciences. And remember that he's going to rule out sense perception altogether by the second one. It has to be a necessary truth. It's only laws. Now, I want to tell you something about what's going on back of this. Aristotle, if you ask him, what is it that's divine? What is it that's the divine reality all the rest depend on? Picks logic as the primary candidate. It's logical truths that are the most certain in existence. And therefore, he wants them to be the most certain in our knowledge. They exist most certainly, and their truth is the most certain truth we can have. And that's his reason for saying it's laws. In other words, it's a religious bias. He's got a belief in the principles of rationality as divine. And therefore, he wants to say only they can be genuinely self-evident. They're the most real and they have the best sort of justification. They're self-evident. So he wants to restrict it. It's actually a religious bias. So if you use those restrictions to say that belief in God can't be self-evident, you've begged the question wildly. You've presumed the existence of a different divinity and therefore ruled out God. Not a very convincing argument. Okay, so he wants everybody to be in agreement because all people are irrational. They'll see it. Only laws, because they're the rational principles, the laws of logic and mathematics. And finally, if they pass those two, Aristotle says, and Descartes echoes him, then it cannot possibly be wrong. There is absolute certainty. It's not only that its experience is certain, it's infallible. That means it's impossible that it be wrong. And that's what they wanted. Now let's take a look at these. And I want to tell you why I find these less than convincing. I'm trying to be polite. Actually, I find them to be crap. Let's start here. It's experienced true by everybody. How would you ever know? How can you know for any truth that everybody who ever lived and everybody who ever will live is going to agree with it? You can't know that. You can't know that for any truth. There's another problem with this. Remember, The ancients believed that you had certainty only if a belief was proven or self-evident. So let's ask of this restriction, is it proven or self-evident? It has to pass its own test, right? Is it experienced true by everyone? Nope. Not experienced true by me. Looks false to me. Therefore, it flunks its own test. So not only can you not know for all the people in the past or the future whether they found a particular belief self-evident, you won't know that, but it itself isn't self-evident by its own restriction. Apply it to itself and it flunks. There are all kinds of expressions for that. Hoist on its own petard is the expression that comes to us from Shakespeare. A petard was a landmine, and if a guy went out and tried to set a landmine and did it wrong and blew himself up, then he was hoist, lifted in the air by his own petard, his own landmine. In contemporary philosophy talk, it's called self-referentially incoherent. When it refers back to itself, it creates an incoherence. It doesn't pass its own test. As long as there's one person who doesn't agree with it, it's not self-evident. So is it proven? And the answer is, nobody's ever even tried to prove it in the 2,300 years since it was proposed. That's because nobody can think of what premises you would ever put down that could yield this. And if you did put down premises that would yield that, would they be self-evident or proven? Apparently not. So nobody ever even gave it a shot. Look at the second one. It's got to be a law. You feel like saying, who says it's got to be a law? Why can't it be self-evident to me that I have a mole somewhere in my body most people don't see, and that I have it removed, but it's still self-evident in my memory that I had it? Nobody else is going to find out. And it's not a law. Well, why is it self-evident? Why does it have to be only laws? Well, I already told you why Aristotle wanted it to be that way. He regarded the laws of logic as divine. That's the divine reality. That's the heart and soul of rationality. He had, in his cosmology, he had an idea of the universe with the earth at the center. Putting the earth at the center of the universe meant it was the worst place in the universe for him. And with every sphere that went out from that, every layer of the universe out, things became less physical and more rational until finally you came to the realm of pure rationality. And there he argued there was a purely rational entity that thought only about itself. And he called it God. But that God was not the creator of the world. That God doesn't care about people. There was no point in worshiping that God because it never had thought about anything but itself. So it clearly stems from a religious belief. Well, let's ask about this. Does it have proof? And if it doesn't, is it self-evident? Well, the same thing applies in the case of this second restriction as applied in the case of the first. Nobody's ever even tried to prove it in the 2,300 years since it was proposed, because nobody can think of what the premises would look like from which you could draw this as an inference. And besides, if you did find some of those premises, the same problems would arise for them over again. Is it proven? Is it self-evident? Now, in this case, however, there's an additional difficulty. For this to be self-evident, it would have to also itself be a law. Because that's what the restriction says. Only laws can be self-evident. So is that statement itself a law? If it's not a law, then this second restriction has no proof and can't be self-evident. But here's the catchy part. Watch this. See, this would also have to be necessary to be self-evident. But the only way you could know whether it was necessary is if it was self-evident, because it doesn't have a proof. So you need to know that it's necessary to know that it's self-evident, and you need to know that it's self-evident to know that it's necessary. So it goes in a hopeless circle, and there's no way to get out of it. So you can't get either one. They might both be true, but they might as well just both be false. There's no way to find out. Finally, there's one other way that you can check on whether a statement is a necessary truth. And this takes little explaining, so I'm going to remove all this stuff. I take it that you've copied it down by now, and if not, you'll back up and copy it down. But I'm going to show you how we can check on whether a statement is a necessary truth or not. The answer is that if it's a necessary truth, you will have to contradict yourself to deny it. Necessary truths all have self-contradictory denials. So take, for example, all bachelors are unmarried. Is that a necessary truth? Well, to deny it, you would have to say some bachelor is married. Is that self-contradictory? Yes, it is. Bachelor means an unmarried person, so saying a bachelor is married contradicts itself. And that shows that this is a necessary truth. So let's try that same thing with the second restriction. Genuine self-evident truths are all necessary truths. The denial of that is some self-evident truths are not necessary truths. Does that contradict itself the way married bachelors does? Is it self-contradictory to say that I looked out the window and I could see that it was raining and that was self-evident to me? Is that self-contradictory just because it's not a necessary truth? But so what? There's nothing about that that looks self-contradictory at all, so there's no reason to believe this is a necessary truth. You know, you see what I mean? The married bachelor is impossible. Is self-evident but not necessary impossible? No, that's the very claim you're trying to make here, but there's no reason to think it's right. We experience self-evident truths all day, every day, that aren't necessary. So why think that this proposal is right and not our experience? And finally, let's take the claim that genuine self-evident truths are infallible. That means there's no way for them to be false. They can't possibly be. And one of the conditions that would have to be true for that to be true is we have some belief-forming capacity which cannot be mistaken. Descartes explicitly says that. When we know something by intuition, it can't be false. But is this true? What reason do we have to think that any capacity we possess can never make a mistake? Our ability to calculate logically and mathematically can make mistakes, right? That's why we have computers. We can add a column of figures and make a mistake. We can try to draw an inference in logic and make a mistake. Think we have a valid argument when we don't. Happens all the time. So what belief forming? Oh, no, it's not that. It's not the ability to calculate, say, Descartes and Aristotle. No, it's our intuition that can't be mistaken. Now look, part of this, by saying it's impossible that it be mistaken, means that we can't think of any set of circumstances under which it could be. I'm going to say it again. For it to be true that there is some capacity to form beliefs that we have that can't possibly be mistaken, it means we cannot think of any set of circumstances under which we would be mistaken using that capacity. I don't think anything survives when you try to say that. Let me tell you why. Suppose I believe that 1 + 1 make 2. And it looks self-evident to me. I haven't inferred that from anything else. It looks true on the face of it. It's just fine the way it is. 1 and 1 is 2. Is there any circumstance that could make me wrong about that? I think there is. Suppose Alpha Centaurians have come to our galaxy and they are encircling the Earth in an invisible spaceship and bombarding the Earth with tachyon waves that make us all think 1 and 1 is 2 when actually it's not. And they're all up there laughing their asses off at us because we think that's a certain truth and they know it's not. I'm not saying that is the case, but remember what this said was, we have an infallible capacity if there's no way to think of any circumstance under which we could be wrong, and there's a circumstance under which we could be wrong about anything. I think only God's infallible. We have to leave infallibility to God. You know, the story in Genesis about the first people with whom God made his covenant and their disobedience. Their disobedience is not described in Genesis as consisting of wanting more on the menu than they were allowed to have. It wasn't really what they wanted to eat. Their motive was, and this was the temptation, God doesn't want you to eat that because he knows that if you do, you'll be as smart as he is. And you'll know things just the way God does. It was their desire to be divine that led them to their fall. They wanted to be infallible. They wanted to know the way God knows and know what God knows. And they said, you ate the fruit I told you not to eat, right? Yeah. We'll leave infallibility for God. And we'll leave the hallowed and ancient restrictions on self-evidency for the trash collectors. That's where it really belongs. And my conclusion from all this is not that there are no self-evident truths. There are. There are more than these people were willing to allow us to have. But we're saying to them, you're not going to dictate from on high what we're allowed to count as self-evident. We will tell you what we experience as self-evident. We can report what we experience as those three characteristics having. And when billions of people say among them is that God exists, you've got no reason to say that's not a genuine self-evidency. You can try to give your own arguments for saying they experience it that way, but they're still mistaken. You could argue it's still a mistake, but they have a powerful justification for that belief. It's not the only justification. There's more to the story. There's more to come. But I wanted you to understand about the restrictions. It's why Christians didn't try to make the claim and why they resorted to proofs instead. And now in our next session, I want to tell you about what some of those proofs are. The next two sessions, we'll look at some of those proofs. I'll explain why they don't work, but I'll also explain why offering such proofs is not a project Christians ought to engage in.